You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the weekly podcast in which I ask my guests to choose their 7 Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. I hope you're all well. If you're coming to the first live recording of Desert Island Dishes this Saturday, I'm so excited to see you there. Scared, but also excited. And thank you so much for all the lovely reviews you've been leaving on iTunes. Genuinely, I read all of them. Cool person that I am. And they really do brighten my day. But beyond that, it really does help other people to find the podcast, which is brilliant because obviously I want to be able to carry on bringing the show to you each week. So if you are listening and you felt like doing your good deed of the day, it really is quick and easy to do. And that would be fab. As Georgie mentions, we did actually record this episode about a year and a half ago now, and she was one of my first ever guests, but we never put it out as an episode. And so I was so happy to be able to re-record and have a bit of a catch up with the lovely Georgie. So many exciting things have happened since then. So grab a cup of tea, maybe a biscuit. Enough waffling from me. Here is today's episode. My guest today is Georgina Hayden. Georgie, otherwise known as Georgie Pudding and Pie to her hordes of loyal followers and fans on Instagram. She is a hugely successful cook, food writer, and stylist from North London. Growing up above her grandparents' Greek Cypriot taverna in Tufnell Park, Georgie developed a passion for cooking. She studied fine art at university, but after graduating, she landed a job as a food writer and stylist at Delicious magazine. She went on to join Jamie Oliver's food team, where she worked for nearly 12 years. She writes, develops, and styles for magazine features, books, television projects, and campaigns. She published her first cookbook, Stirring Slowly, a few years ago, and we are now only a mere few months away from the publication of her new book, Taverna. Welcome, Georgie Pudding and Pie.
Hello!
What a great name, by the way.
Oh, do you know what? I've been really toying with changing it.
Have you?
Yeah.
Going to go to just your name?
Well, I feel like I've outgrown it a bit because, you know, I joined Instagram many, many moons ago and was obviously younger and it was a bit more fun. And yeah, I don't know. I keep toying with the idea and my husband's like, oh no, but I don't know. It's funny, isn't it? It's funny world social media. I don't really get social media, if I'm honest.
Is it a bit like how some people still have their original Hotmail address?
I mean, I only just got rid of mine.
What was yours?
Oh my God, it was Chou Fleur. I was a cauliflower.
Oh,
is
my
it cauliflower?
God.
Yeah, that is cauliflower. I just love, but you've got to remember, I remember not having email. So I got my first email address when I was about 18. And I just really liked the word Chou Fleur.
I think that's very sophisticated.
Really?
I think mine was Pink Pineapple.
I mean, that's really cute. You're probably younger than me, and that's really cute. As opposed to being an 18-year-old with a cauliflower.
Let's pretend I was younger.
No.
but we actually met a few years ago at a competition. Yeah. Well, I didn't realise when I turned up to the competition that the prize was a trip to India.
I know.
And then you won it.
Yeah, but I didn't go.
Yeah.
I know, don't. You know, I tried to re-gift it to you.
Did you?
Did I not tell you that? Yeah, because because we'd been trying for a baby for such a long time, and I just thought, you know what, when your life is sort of on hold in a certain way and you try, you know, I thought, oh, India's one of my favorite places in the world, and I thought, sod it, I'm gonna enter this competition, it'll be really fun. And then I won, which was brilliant. But then as it happened, obviously I got pregnant a month later. So I couldn't go to India on this incredible trip to go to tea plantations. And obviously the baby, who is now Persephone, was a much better gift and much,
yeah, better prize. Much better price.
But I did email the people from the competition and said, oh, you know, obviously Margie was the next best one. So can she go instead? Oh, I swear on my life I did that and they couldn't do it.
Let's jump straight into the first desert island dish. So I know that initially you didn't think of going into food as a career. You were really academic at school and surrounded by a family who loved food. And you were just brought up to kind of think that that was the norms.
I mean, you're being very kind when you say really academic.
Georgie, that's what it said in my research.
I was a bit of a geek at school. I was actually probably just like average, but I loved school anyway. And I love maths, which is what I think probably they're referencing. I'm a bit slow off the mark sometimes. I don't think I realised that having a world that is centred around food isn't everyone's reality. And actually, even now, at the, you know, ripe old age of 36, it's sort of still occurring to me. There's all these things that are happening from my childhood and my life. I was like, oh God, that's not normal, actually. So where I was, you know, relatively academic, or I loved school or whatever, I didn't think that food was a career. I just thought that everyone's lives were around food. And it didn't hit me until I was actually at university in sort of early 20s that maybe I should follow that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such an interesting point. Like when something is just the norm to you, kind of just imagine that everyone else is living the same life.
Well, this is it. You know, what do you mean you didn't grow up at a restaurant and you don't get fed 20 times a day? You know, like I remember being 7 and having my tonsils out. And back then, you know, God bless NHS, but you could stay in hospital for a few weeks as opposed to being kicked out the next day. And I was in hospital for a while and our restaurant was down the road and my mum and dad would bring me freshly cooked food every night from my grandparents, you know, Greek, delicious home cooked Greek food. And I remember turning to my mum and dad crying, saying, I just want to eat what the other children are eating, which was the crappy hospital food.
Oh my goodness.
And kicking up a right old stink. And, you know, my God, what a spoiled brat.
Yeah, but as a child, you just want to be the same as everyone else.
You just want to fit in, don't you?
Well, let's talk about the first desert island dish. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Oh my gosh. Okay, well, that's really hard when you've grown up in a household, which is just based around food. You know what? It's actually occurred to me recently, because it's something I don't cook for myself anymore, is after years of being a vegetarian. I now eat meat, but I'm not in the habit of cooking myself a steak.
Okay.
However, I did recently, and I think because of the restaurants, the smell of cooking steak, it almost punched me in the face a little bit. I was like, oh my God. So basically, we had this restaurant and it was all Cypriot dishes, as well as being sort of steakhouse and kebabs and all that. So, you know, so there's a real smell of meat. And then I gave up eating meat in my sort of early teens. And my dad, because he was such a carnivore, when we had the restaurant, someone dared him to go for a month without eating meat. And anyway, he felt so good afterwards. He's never eaten meat since.
Really?
So he's now not eaten meat for about 25 years. So it was really funny. So for my whole sort of first 10 years of my life, the smell of steak and kebabs and searing meat was such a delicious and evocative smell. And then it sort of just very quickly disappeared, because I then became vegetarian. My grandparents retired. My dad stopped eating meat. I did. My sister did too. So it was something that sort of disappeared from my life quite quickly. And then recently, you know, I was searing a delicious ribeye, and I just was like the biggest hit in the face. And I go, God, that smell just
really takes you back.
Yeah, I was in the restaurant again and I was 8 and it was just wonderful, actually.
So that's very interesting that you became a vegetarian and then you stopped being a vegetarian.
Yes.
How did that happen?
The opposite way.
Yeah.
The rest of
against
the world.
The current trend.
Well, so yeah, during my teens and whatever, I still like to think I try and live a sort of conscious life. I try and do things and be environmentally aware and whatever. And I didn't learn to drive because it was bad for the environment until I was very old. Very old, that's a lie. You know, with my late 20s compared to, say, being 17.
Yeah. I mean. So you were really aware of stuff like that.
Yeah. And when I was vegetarian, I wasn't just, you know, I didn't eat gelatin, I didn't wear leather, you know, all those kind of things. So not just sort of a faddy vegetarian, like I was just very ethically aware. And then I took a few years off and I went to art school, whatever, and then I went to uni, and it was whilst I was at uni, I realized I wanted to work with food. So I sort of started to become more interested in food and where it came from, as opposed to just being, no, I'm not going to eat meat. And around the same time, I actually became very ill. So I've always been anemic. It's hereditary. It's, you know, you find lots of sick people are anemic. And my anemia got really bad. And it was my last year at uni, and I couldn't even get on the train home from Leeds to London because I just couldn't get out of bed. I was so weak. And my doctor just, you know, I was constantly being checked my iron levels, and, you know, the tablets and whatever weren't working. And I was eating loads of lentils. You know, we have a diet rich in lentils and spinach and stuff in Cyprus. And he just said, look, you're going to have iron infusions, like drips, because you're just not getting enough iron. You need something, you need to change your diet. So I then just started investigating it more. And that's when I reintroduced meat into my diet. It was partly from a fascination and wanting to work in food. And it was partly because my body was telling me, actually, you know, if people want to cut out food groups and do what they want to do, it's their choice. But, you know, we are all built differently.
Yeah.
You know, there was definitely certain countries and nationalities where they can't consume dairy, whereas, you know, we have for like hundreds of years now, we are more adapted. There's different parts of the world, you know, and I'm from a part of the world where iron absorption is just a problem. You know, even now I eat meat, and during pregnancy with Persephone, I still had to have drips.
That's so interesting. And I mean, you're right, because there is no one size fits all, which is the problem with a lot of the food advice and everything like that that's happening at the moment.
You just have to be really careful and listen to yourself. You know, I've got a friend who's been vegan for a few years, and she was so upset. She turned to me the other day and she said, you know, my doctor says to me, I have to start eating dairy because I'm so frightfully low in these certain vitamins. And you can take the tablets, but what I think a lot of people don't understand is that not everything is equal. You know, great, you can be a vegetarian and eat loads of lentils, but the iron that you'd get from eating red meat is not the same as the iron you're going to get from lentils. It's not absorbed in the same way. Your body doesn't extract it the same way. So whilst I ate really well, it wasn't enough. And even now, as a meat eater, and during pregnancy, I was drinking Spartone and tablets and all that, I still had to have drips. So it still goes to show, doesn't you? We're all built differently. But
yeah,
I don't eat a lot of meat, maybe once a week,
okay,
twice a week, just because, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, so after university, so you studied fine art at university, and then your first job was with Delicious magazine.
Yeah, well, it was, it was a runner's job. So basically, when I was in my last year at uni, and I had this epiphany of wanting to work in food, Delicious had just launched. It'd been that year. And, you know, the food scene wasn't what it is now. It wasn't like particularly trendy. Obviously, food's always been big, but it wasn't trendy. There was no Instagram or whatever. There wasn't even Facebook. Anyway, so I wrote to Delicious and was like, can I just come in and do a work experience placement? And they were like, yeah, great. So I did. My tutor sort of just let me go off for 2 weeks and do that. And I just thought I'd end up being like a designer or something. And I went on my first food shoot and I just had this real moment. I was like, oh my God. There's someone whose job it is to write about food, cook the food for photography. I was like, that is it. So I very much had my eye on the prize. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I went on this day and I just thought, that is it. So I stayed in touch. And then as I was coming up to graduation, they had this 3-month temporary job. It was like being a food runner. So yeah, the publishing house that had Delicious also had Sainsbury's magazine and a few other magazines. So I was just there for 3 months as this like Christmas elf sorting out their Christmas products. And I basically just tried to make myself sort of, you know, as needed as possible. And they kept me on as the sort of in-house assistant. And I was there for exactly a year.
Before you got snapped up by Jamie Oliver.
Yeah. And then through that, I met Jamie's head stylist, who's Ginny. And at the time, it was just her and Anna Jones. And then I was there for 12 years.
That's so interesting. So you joined the Jamie Oliver team when it was still sort of in its infancy.
I mean, yeah, he must have. I mean, he was a huge deal at the time. Don't get me wrong. He'd already been around for sort of maybe like 5 or 6 years, no longer probably. But it was tiny. The team was tiny. I mean, it's grown massively since then.
How exciting is that you've been part of Delicious right at the start and then Jamie Oliver? I mean, and feeling that there's a common thread, Georgie, responsible?
I mean, I don't want to claim anything, Marty, but all I'm going to say is this is my address. And if you want to send me some thanks, that's great.
They owe me a lot.
Yeah. No, do you know what? It's just determination and just hard work. And I guess a certain amount of luck as well. But yeah, feel very lucky.
Let's talk about the second desert island dish. Mm. And that's the first dish that you learned to cook.
My sort of first real clear memories of cooking was always with my mum. I was lucky that my mum was around, like stay-at-home mum, and well, we had the restaurant, so you know, whatever, but she always baked with us, and I just really clearly always remember making fairy cakes with red and green glacé cherries. There was always green ones as well, and yeah, just making like little buns, not like, you know, your big muffins with your cream cheese frostings and all that malarkey, just little tiny little fairy cakes with cherries, and sometimes we'd chop off the tops and make them into little wings.
Oh yeah.
And just with whipped double cream, you know, nothing.
Ooh, what, in the middle?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And then like a icing, like a glaze, or no? No.
So like the glaze ones had the glacé cherries, and then the ones that were fairy cakes would slice at the top and slice them in half and put some cream and then put them as wings.
Oh yeah. Like, that sounds good. A very different beast to the American.
Oh my God. I still, don't get me wrong, I'll make them, but I can't get on board with those, whether it's like half sponge, half sugary buttercream. No, I'm not into it.
Yeah, they're very different.
I prefer like a little drizzle icing, if anything.
Interesting. Yeah. Also, I think they're much easier to eat, the fairy cakes,
much
aren't they?
Easier
and
to
because
eat.
They're called fairy cakes, they sort of feel
magic.
they feel very light and dainty.
Exactly, just like me.
Yeah. So for anyone who may not be aware, what exactly is a food stylist?
So a food stylist is someone, it can vary. So a food generally is basically someone who cooks food for photography or for TV. So when you are, when you pick up your cookbook, occasionally the writer will have cooked the food in the photographs, but you know, if the person writing it is just a very, you know, they're writing and that is their thing, the publisher will often employ a food stylist to make the food for the photography, because cooking food for photography and the way you plate it up is different to just how you plate it up at home, obviously.
Yeah.
So
what, does your food not always look exactly how it looks in the books,
always,
Georgie?
Looks so beautiful, and it's always just, you know, got a glaze on it. But yeah, so it's, you know, it's making food as aesthetically appealing as possible. And the same for TV, it's those sort of, you know, if someone's on, you know, Jamie's on telly and he's cooking a brisket for 5 hours, you know, they haven't got 5 hours to wait for that to cook. So there'll be a team of food stylists behind the scenes getting everything ready. So there's all the different stages are ready to swap in. Mm. So everything is efficient as possible.
That's so interesting. And I guess there are so many different types of food stylists, because you could be on a huge advert production,
exactly,
or TV show. Like, do you have a particular
specialism?
Yeah.
So you have different types of food. Like, generally, I think just for us, because I trained with Jamie's team, and Jamie, we had to sort of do everything. So we did things from like ads, commercials, like Sainsbury's commercials and whatever back in those days, and also his books. So my training is such that I guess I've done editorial, which is the more sort of visually, you know, pleasing stuff, like for magazines and books, and then the big stuff like the ads. So, you know, ads are a completely different beast. They may be less artistic, but there's real fun with them. There's real adrenaline with doing ads.
And did you ever have to do any of the weird stuff, like a steaming tea bag, glaze?
Well, not with Jamie.
Varnish.
Oh my goodness. No. Thankfully, Jamie has always been very, you know, the food that you see on telly has to be edible. He never wanted to do any trickery, which I totally respect. But I have had to do jobs with things like the steaming tampon.
Oh.
Do you know about the tampon?
No.
So this is one of my sort of favourite ones. If you see like a steaming chicken on telly or a steaming turkey, obviously they only steam for a certain amount of time. And if you're filming, that scene can take a whole day to film. You know, that turkey is not going to it's going to steam for hours on end, is it? So what you do is you get a bowl of boiling water and you snip up some tampons and you put them in the boiling water.
Stop it, Georgie.
True story. And then you put the bowl of tampons in the microwave, and then they're basically steaming hot, and then you put them inside the cavity of said poultry, and then you've got a steaming hot poultry.
Wow.
Well, beautiful.
I've learned something new today.
Yeah, so there you go. Next time you see that ad on telly, you will not look at that chicken the same way.
No, definitely not.
It's definitely got tampon there.
But I think there's something to be said about the way that Jamie does it, because that feels more, it feels more honest in the sense it's sort of
accessible.
Yeah, it's more achievable. Like you're saying, we've done this,
yes,
and therefore you can do it too. Whereas otherwise it's sort of, I don't know, it's kind of setting expectations that people can't live up to.
The thing is, you're always going to get people complaining, going, oh, my meal didn't take 15 minutes, or mine doesn't look like the book. And then say, that is just life, right?
Yeah, you're not a professional.
Well, I can't do my tax return the same way an accountant can, right? We've all got skills in life, let's be honest. But at the end of the day, I guess when you're someone as big a name as Jamie or whoever, you want to be able to turn around and say, actually, that was done in 15 minutes, or that is just the way it looks. It's not because we've covered it in nail varnish, whatever. Like, you need to have the ability to say that is true. Like, you know, when I worked there, we did do the 15 minute meal books or 30 minute meal books. And it's something that people still say to me when I tell them sort of my, what I've done for a living. They're like, oh, nothing ever takes that time. And I just keep my mouth shut because I'm not going to get in an argument with someone that I've met in a pub. I'm not that person. But equally, I'm the person that's been stood in that kitchen with a timer. And, you know, we have had to do it. Three rounds of people have had to do it so we can do it in that time. Because if you can't prove it, then you're just lying, aren't you?
And yeah.
I think that's, you know, the great thing about, well, not just Amy, but, you know, lots of magazines do those sort of things now. And I think it's great.
Yeah. That's also really interesting because there's, like, they're obviously really different jobs if you're using the varnish and all of those other things versus just focusing solely on the food and on the sort of ability of the chef. It's a different kind of thing, isn't it? And equally interesting.
Yeah, I did a job last month which was, you know, it wasn't more varnishy and whatever, but it did involve tweezers. And I just loved it, actually, because that's where my sort of art background comes out. I just, you know, it wasn't particularly food, well, it wasn't foodie at all. Foodie, well, not that sort of horrible word, but, you know, it wasn't food driven. It wasn't a beautiful food shot, but it was an advertising shot and it did involve a toolbox and tweezers and spray mount and blue tack. And I'm there going, oh my God, I love this.
Yeah, so fun. I think my husband always gets a bit alarmed when I pull out the tweezers in the kitchen, but yeah, I love it. What else goes into your little toolkit? Because I heard that didn't you have a bit of a drama one time at an airport?
I just wanted to maximize my holidays, so I used to often just fly straight after work, and I can't remember going Vietnam, I think, and I didn't even think, I just basically legged it out of this photo shoot. It was like, bye, and went straight to Heathrow, and I'd forgotten I had one of my wraps in my bag which had tweezers, and it didn't have scalpels or anything like that, but
it didn't have your knives.
Didn't have my knives, no. Well, I have a range of wraps. So this one is a little one.
Okay.
It's like a painter's wrap, and it will have a selection of paintbrushes and tweezers. But when I say tweezers, I mean like we get them from surgical suppliers. So we're not talking like eyebrow tweezers, we're talking
they're
like
big ones.
Doctor's tweezers. Anyway, so I went into Heathrow, and I don't know how they let me through four flights with it. And I, when we got to Hong Kong, they did stop me and I said, well, I'm a doctor.
You were
thank God no one was on the flight.
Oh my God, imagine. And they'd be like, oh, don't worry, we have actually got a doctor on board. She's got her kit with her.
Well, those kits are expensive. Like, that was like worth a lot of money. I wasn't about to just chuck it in the bin.
No.
If I had to chuck it in the bin, I was like, I'm going to try and blag it first.
Yeah, you got to try.
I tried.
Like that sneaky bottle of water. You always got to try.
I know. It's not vodka, I promise.
Let's talk about the third desert island dish. And that's the best dish you've ever eaten.
Do you know what? This is such a hard question. Because let's be honest, Margie, let's tell them the truth. We've recorded this before, haven't we? So we recorded this a year and a half ago, but I had a very little baby who liked to make herself known. So we're doing this again, aren't we?
Yes.
And it's really funny. I was trying to remember what I said to you last time. Not only have I got a terrible memory, but I also was post-pregnancy brain. So I have no recollection of what I said to you a year and a half ago.
It'd be kind of fun to put that out.
Zero recollection at all. So favorite dish I've ever eaten. Oh my God, that is just... Because
what you mean is this answer might not be the same as the last one, but it's because it's such a difficult question that it can change on any given day.
Because I definitely remember the first dish I learned to cook was definitely fairy cakes last time as well, because that is just the first, that's just fact. Was the favorite dish, like I'm a hugely nostalgic person. So for me, food is very much about, you know, so Stirring Slowly is all about family. Taverna is all about family. Like what I do is I'm very nostalgic. I'm a hugely maternal cook. Like when I say maternal cook, I don't mean because I'm a mother. I would have always described myself that way. I cook to nourish. And I think that's the best food for me is often the food that's been cooked with love. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a Michelin star meal. You know, I've eaten some great food in Michelin star restaurants. The irony being, I couldn't actually probably tell you what they were.
Yeah.
Whereas if I went to someone's home and they cooked for me, you know, with soul and love, and I could tell you exactly what I ate if it was 15 years ago. So,
such a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. But at the moment, I think one of the most memorable meals for me was the day before my daughter was born.
Yeah, tell us.
So, we knew when we were having Persephone because she was a planned section, and it was a Tuesday, the 20th of June. And we hadn't told anyone the exact day because, you know, we were just quite scared or whatever. And then the day before, my husband took the day off work and we had this very surreal day, and we'd had a really stressful few months in the lead up, and not just with the pregnancy, but our house was, you know, a complete tip. We were having building work and life was just awful. And we had this, not awful, but stressful. Anyway, we had this one day where we kicked the builders out and they'd literally kicked them out on Saturday. And we woke up on this Monday and we just had, and it was this summer, which was glorious. And we just went back. We went to our favorite restaurant, which is Rochelle Canteen, for lunch. Mm. And it was so hot. It was about 30 degrees. And we sat in the garden and it was just, you know, it was our last meal before she arrived. And it was just heaven. And I'll never forget sitting in the garden with the most delicious cherry sorbet. And it was just like eating just nectar. It was truly divine. And it was just this very blissful moment where everything felt okay and all the stress had just sort of disappeared. And actually we had this hope in our life that felt like it was going to come true. And it was just, it was magic. Like, yeah. You know, I'm not claiming that it was, you know, the most delicious thing that's ever passed my lips. But for me at this moment in my life, it was just one of the most memorable and heavenly moments. It was really special.
Such a momentous moment, sort of knowing that very soon everything is going to change.
And it was just that wash of, you know, we had a really tough time. Our son had died of, you know, 3 years previously, and we'd been through a lot, and not only with him passing away, but also with the pregnancy and other superficial stuff like house stuff. And life had just been mad, and it was just this really calm moment. And you know, we finally, there was this time, you know, this very split second where I was like, actually, it might be, you know, she should be here. You know, I sort of hadn't let myself really sort of believe it,
yeah.
I think. And it was just sitting in this garden, which if you've, you know, people have been to Rochelle Canteen, they'll know it's very beautiful. It's this old school in East London. So you're in this sort of contained, beautiful space. And it was just very serene. And this cherry sorbet was, you know, and it was searingly hot. And this sorbet was just refreshing and sweet and delicious. And I think it was one of my favourite moments.
Georgie, that's made me feel a bit emotional.
Sorry.
I can tell you that your previous answer to that question,
oh God, go on,
which I do want to talk about just because it sounded so delicious,
oh God,
was a soup that your grandmother made. So it's a
my afko lemoni.
Yeah. So tell us about God. It.
So that recipe is in Taverna and I just love afko lemoni. It's very simple. It's a chicken soup essentially. And all Greek people will know it. It's where you poach a chicken for hours and you've got the beautiful stock and then you take the meat out and in the stock you cook rice and then you whisk lots of eggs with lots of lemon juice, fresh lemon juice. And then what you do is you very, very, at the end, very quickly, you cook the beaten lemony eggs into the chicken stock and rice, which sounds really mad, but it creates a very creamy soup with tanginess but richness from the chicken and comfortingness from the rice. And it's just, you know, people say chicken soup is you know, the Jewish penicillin or whatever, and it is just that sort of nourishing, homely. There's always cinnamon sprinkled on at the end. And I'm just not doing it justice. It's one of my favorite things. I'll eat it, you know, every week until I die if I could.
And am I right in remembering, I might have this wrong, do you add grated halloumi on top of it?
No, that is, I think that's another thing my granny made, where she would poach the chicken and in the same sort of way she would then cook pasta into the chicken stock.
Yes.
And then that would always be, it's funny because grated halloumi is like, for us it's, you know, it's parmesan.
Yeah.
And I said it to someone the day and they were like, grated? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess if you don't think of it, you know, as in England, obviously halloumi is something you grill, it's a squeaky cheese,
whatever. Yeah.
But for us it's parmesan, it's, you know, pecorino, it's, well, you finish your dishes with grated halloumi. I mean,
yeah,
why wouldn't you?
It's quite a recent discovery for me too, and it's amazing.
It's just divine.
It is definitely the squeaky cheese.
it is, but oh my gosh, yeah, grated halloumi and everything.
Something that you also said in our previous chat, which I wanted to come back to because I thought it was so interesting, was we talked about how there's kind of been a shift away from the kind of jobs that we're all doing at the moment,
yeah,
and how physically demanding jobs are taking a bit of a back seat. And I thought, I was talking about how everyone thinks of something like a food stylist as being very glamorous, but it's really hard work and it's really physically demanding, as is being a chef.
Yeah, 100%.
And how there has been a shift away from people wanting to do physically tiring jobs when I guess the perception, maybe not the reality, but the perception is that there are slightly less demanding jobs out there.
Yeah, I completely, and I think this is, this is something that's, I really think is true. And I think, it, you know, social media has a lot to, you know, a part to play in this, because, you know, you can, and there are people out there who have become hugely successful from having a lovely Instagram account where actually what they do is they just eat, I say just, but you know, they eat out at restaurants, they take a nice picture and they post on Instagram, and that is their career. And that is great and good for them. And I think we're in a society now where, you know, because that is a reality and you can do that, people strive for that in a way, as opposed to maybe the jobs that involve graft. So for me, my experience, you know, and fine, I don't have a huge following on Instagram. I'm not like, you know, but, you know, my Instagram, I try and take a nice picture. I've got an art background. It's not for any other reason than that's what I do. I'm trained in that, you know, my eye is an arty eye, but that's all I do, you know? So it's not like I'm also an accountant on the side. That's
yeah.
my thing, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I do it as part of a job which involves hard graft, you know, food styling. If you are a fully proper food stylist, and by that I don't mean just for social media, I mean your job, your bread and butter is to go and work on TV shows and ads. 16-hour days are standard. That is not abnormal at all. You know, you are running around, you are lugging crates of not just food, but like when you're going on a set and you're filming for days on end, you're often in places that don't even have kitchens. So you have to carry ovens. You know, we would take, yeah. we're doing Christmas ads, which would involve cooking, you know, endless turkeys. We're filming it in a street in Yorkshire. You're in a caravan, you're in like a trailer. You've got six ovens on the go. You're lugging all that stuff. So it's hugely physical.
Yeah.
And I mean, I love that because I really love adrenaline. And I think what a lot of people don't realize is it's just as physical as chefing or, you know, any of those kinds of jobs, but it's just different. And, you know, if social media is your thing, that is brilliant. But we are, I think, moving away from the sort of people wanting to do the more manual jobs. Like, you know, I would get asked lots of times for people to come and help. And when we were in Jamie's, for, you know, for sure, like, people would come in and I don't think everyone always realized maybe how physical or unglamorous it is actually yeah. behind the scenes. And actually I've just got in touch with my secondary school because I went to a really just an inner city girls school, state school, nothing, you know, and they play a massive part in my sort of feminist beliefs. And I don't think I realized that until I was quite old. And they very much, oh, would I say that? God, that's an awful thing to say. Until I was older. But, you know, it was very much ingrained in us that we could just do anything. Just, you know, I say just because we were women,
yeah.
we could do anything. And I've never, ever looked at anything in life and thought, I can't do that. There was never a part of me. So it's really interesting, this sort of big rise in Me Too and everyone, you know, shouting loud now, which is fantastic. Growing up, we were just told that we could do anything we wanted to do. And so I got in touch with school recently and I was like, you know, we had women come in, talk to us about different careers. And I was like, I would like to go in and do that. Not because I necessarily think I'm wicked or I've done anything great, but I think it's really important to empower the next generation where, yes, great, through certain platforms, you can do jobs which maybe are social media related or YouTube and all those kind of things. Brilliant. But also graft is good.
Yeah.
Graft is important. You yeah. need to work hard. If you want to do all right, you need to, you know, put in time and effort. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. And I think it sort of goes back to the whole thing of the idea of an overnight success. It's sort of not a reality. Like, so
some people do.
I mean, some people,
of course, but some people do, but it is
quite rare. And for the most part, there's a lot of hard work
100%.
And a lot of hours that go into that. And I think the more we can talk about that, the more important it is, because if that overnight success isn't happening to you,
yeah.
you could feel quite down in the dumps.
And I 100%, I read something yesterday, which I thought was really interesting. And I talk about social media a lot, but I think it has a lot to play in that, you know, we're of a time now where I think people, and I definitely feel this way, are always thinking we need to be bigger. We need to do more. We need to be more successful. And it's like, actually just stop for a minute. I'm all right.
Yeah.
You know, if this year I don't, you know, I'm not in a position next year where I've got something bigger or better than the year before, that is okay. You know, like I left Jamie's last June and I had been there for 12 years and my husband has currently been in his job for 13 and a half years. And that's really rare. Like people would say to me, God, 12 years, or like, God, you've been there for 13 years. And I think it's really rare to sort of be okay with with being okay. Like, we're, you know, we're sort of striving for more and bigger and everyone's doing this and you can shout about stuff. But the reality is, like, actually, it's just to be happy is actually all that matters. And if you can do that and do something you love and care about, then that's great, really.
That's the goal. Let's talk about something slightly less serious.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
No, the fourth desert island.
What a jump.
What is your favourite sandwich? Perfect segue.
I mean, so relevant. Do you know what? I'm going to say that I probably did say this last time as well. Did I say ham and cheese?
Yes.
I'm so cliche. I just love ham and cheese. I'm such a salt fiend.
Do you know what you actually said last time?
Oh my God, don't.
You said that you play a game.
I was going to come on to this. If you were a sandwich, what would you be?
Yeah.
Like, that is my favourite thing. Like, your desert island dishes, I am. If you were a sandwich, what would you be? I think it says a lot about a person. So for me, it's ham and cheese.
Okay, so not only because you like to eat it, but you think that kind of sums you up as a person.
Yeah.
So talk me through that.
It would be, and I... pretty sure I would have said there would have been some sort of chutney in there as well. Yeah, exactly. So I think it sounds better as a person because it's comforting, it's nostalgic, which I am, it's homely, it's a bit cheesy, again, which I am, and it definitely has to, it's salt driven, which I think if you were to dissect me as a scientist, you would say that sugar is not my problem. It is definitely salt.
You're 98% salt.
I'm 98% Malden. And then there'd have to be chutney in there because I definitely have a bit of a fiery side.
I like that game. I don't know what that would make me, but...
Like mustard like or chutney. It'd be mustard or chutney because I've definitely got like... There's a fieriness to me.
I like that take on the sandwich.
Yeah. What would you be? Am I allowed to ask you?
I mean, the only thing that springs to mind, which I may well cut this, but I had one of those... body, what are they, like a body fat scanner thing when I was at university, so a long time ago. And the results, the trainer said to me, he was like, okay, not to sort of alarm you.
Oh, shut up, don't.
But it's kind of the same as a prawn sandwich. That made me laugh a lot. So I don't know.
So you're a
prawn? I'm a prawn sandwich.
That's hilarious. I love that. I love a prawn mayo.
Oh, so good. So good. So I want to talk about, obviously, Stirring Slowly, which was a phenomenal success. Aww. And it feels like it's been around for much longer than a few years because genuinely people are always telling me that it's their favorite all-time
cookbook. When you said that, that's so nice. Do you know what I think I like about Stirring Slowly? Like, we were talking about overnight successes and stuff, and I think when you write a cookbook, it takes a long time to write and create, and you put it out in the world, and it's really nerve-wracking, and you want people to love it because I poured my heart and soul into it, and you know, of course, there's a part of everyone that would love to have something that is an overnight success, you know, just because then it means, you know, financially as well, that you're getting, you know, being able to do something you love, which is a dream. Let's all be honest. But at the same time, I was really adamant that I didn't want to. All I want to do is write about food. Basically, that's my dream in life. And I equally didn't want to do something that was faddy or felt like it would date. And I think the thing that I'm really proud of Stirring Slowly is that it seems like it's just been very consistent.
Yeah, which is amazing.
It's a dream, you know, like it wasn't the sort of thing that was like peaked and dwindled off and no one remembers it. Like, it just seems like it's still, which I love. Like, I get tagged in stuff and you know, I can't downplay the fact that if someone tags me in something they've made, like the buzz.
The best feeling.
It's just the best feeling ever. Like, someone has made, there is someone out there who has just made a recipe that you've written. It is the best feeling.
Yeah,
how
amazing.
Happens, it's the best feeling.
Yeah. And so the second book, which is out in a couple of months, which is so exciting. Oh. How was that different to writing the first book?
I mean, different in that it's my family's story. So it's a book that it sounds like I'm lying, but I'm not. I started writing it years ago. Like, I found a file on my very old computer called Cypress Book. Imaginatively. And that was a trip that I did 13 years ago to Cyprus. I was 12 years ago. I was just been at Jamie's and I took a month off and I went, it was in May, and I basically traveled around Cyprus on my own. I've got loads of family over there, whatever. And I went and stayed in the various villages and learnt from all the various relatives. And, you know, so I had my eye on that project for years. So,
so in many ways, this could have been the first book.
Yes,
you wrote.
And it was almost the first book. And, you know, part of me thinks, you know, what would my life be if that had been the first book or whatever? But Yes, and it could have been the first book.
No, I think it's exciting that you've done it the other way around.
Yeah, and also, I guess the other thing was I didn't want to, as much as Cypriot food is my blood and my lifeline, and I want to jump up on the rooftops and say to everyone, it's amazing. I also, you know, I love writing about all types of food.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not the only thing you're known for.
But, you know, my family story. And I also think there's so many amazing ethnic books out there. No one has done a Cypriot book. And I think the thing about Cypriot food that really gets me
is that really true?
Well, there are, but they're bloody old.
Yeah.
Like, there's no current ones. There's not a book that has been written about Cypriot food that is less than, and that I know anyway, that isn't old, you
That's
know?
That's so exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting because I think for a lot of people, Greece and Greek food is they love. I get people some of the time, I love Greek food. And Middle Eastern food is still riding a massive wave, you know, doing phenomenally well. And I think for me, Cyprus is a blend of the two. It's Greek food, which is familiar, but it's got the interestingness of Middle Eastern food because it's basically next to Lebanon and Syria. And, you know, so we have all the orange blossom and the cumin, the coriander and coriander, you know, all that stuff. So I think it's brilliant.
Oh, I'm so excited for it.
Anyway, it's been very emotional to write as well because my family is very part of it.
So. Oh, yeah. The little sneaky peek that I've had, it looks incredible.
Thank you, love.
Let's talk about the fifth desert island dish, and that's the dish you eat the most often.
So we were talking about Afghan lemony before. So I would say that soup is something that I eat a lot. It's just for my family. It's delicious. If we're ever poorly, my mum or my yaya, my grandma will come around and make it. Like that is just, it's just something that's always there. Afghan lemony, it was always there. Where interestingly, even though I can make it, it's one of those things that gets made for me.
That is interesting.
Yeah, so my mum will make it, my AI will make it.
And it just tastes better when someone else makes it.
I mean,
it for you.
Yeah, I'm like, great, I can make it, but mum, can you just do it?
Yeah.
The dish, so other than that, the thing that I make probably the most often when I'm not cooking Greek food is I just love Indian food or Asian food, like spices. I'm a big spice person. So something like nasi goreng is a real staple in our house for lots of reasons, just because it's so store cupboard friendly. We traveled around Indonesia for our honeymoon and it was one of the best months of my life and it was great. And nasi goreng was something we ate loads. And I love the spices. I love the flavors. I love how flexible it is, but I also think it's a great after dinner recipe. And I did put it in stirring slowly for all those reasons, and it's and now with the baby as well, it's something she loves as well. So it's a real family friendly thing. It's a quick thing. It's one of those things that it's a good yeah, I like to just have several meals.
It's like
when I had my roast chicken, I then just like to have a side of nasi
goreng. I was like, that is something I can get on board with. I like where she's going with this.
I mean, yeah, no.
You did say you were more savory than sweet.
I am. That's why I could just...
Do you have that as a pudding?
Yeah, just pudding. Just nasi goreng for pudding.
And tell me, because something very exciting has happened. Not only have you got the new book coming out, but you've got a new column in Delicious Magazine.
Yeah! That is, oh my God, I cried when Karin messaged me. Karin's the editor. And
is that how it happened? Just she sent an email out of the blue?
Well, we met at a talk that we did about food writing, food styling, food publications and whatever. And we met and we just got on really well. And when I went freelance, I just got in touch with lots of people and said, I'm going freelance, you know, let me know if you ever want to work together. And yeah, I just was blown away. I mean, so many reasons, obviously, because it's what I want to do. I want to write about food. But, you know, Delicious was how I started. So talk about coming full circle.
Yeah.
That was 14 and a half years ago that I did the work experience.
Also, that wouldn't have been Karin then, would it?
No.
It would have been a different
episode. It was different. It was Mitzi Wilson, and then it was Matthew Drennan. So yeah, long time ago. So yeah, 14 years ago. And it's really weird. I remember walking into Delicious on my first day of my work experience, and the girl that was on reception is now one of my lifelong friends.
Really?
Yeah, we're still absolute besties. Like, it's so weird. It's such a, yeah.
God, so it's like really been a part of your life.
Yeah, huge part of my life. So, you know, not only a dream to write a column, but for a publication that I think is the best out there. Like, I'm not just saying that. I think Delicious is, I had a subscription for years, nothing to do with whatever. I just think it's brilliant. So yeah, really, really lucky. And also on another note, I do think we need more female voices in food. I don't want to sound sexist or anything like that, but I think for a long time, you know, like for TV, I think we're still really, really bloody slow, actually. It's still mainly male-dominated. And unfortunately, the women that represent food and food writing and cooking are, you know, often tend to be models for some reason. I'm like, come on, guys, let's get some real people. So it's a bit of a shame the TV world is so slow off the mark, if I'm honest. You know, there's all these amazing women out there. And why is it that all the half-hour cooking shows are still men?
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Some of them are really handsome. But, you know, why is it we can't get women? And I just think it's really... really behind time.
I think shows like Saturday Kitchen do a good, they're doing a good job at the moment.
They are.
Of showcasing different people. I've been quite impressed with them.
Saturday Kitchen, I think, is the only thing that I'm just like, good, come on.
Yeah.
Seriously, they get great women, interesting women. And I'm like, someone give some of these women a half hour show. Jeez, like how behind the times are we? So, you know, from that point of view as well, and as an ethnic minority, you know, I think as well, it's just really, we need to have diversity. So.
I think basically what we're saying here, Georgie, is someone get Georgie a TV show.
No way. Oh, yeah. I've got a face for radio.
Oh, shush. That's
face for podcast. No, I've got no desire to be on TV, but, you know, just to have some more female diversity out there, it's really important.
Yeah. You can't be what you can't see. So it is really important that we start seeing much more of all of that. We're on to the sixth desert island dish, and that is your go-to dinner party dish.
Do you know what? It's a new one. It's a new one now.
Tell us.
So it definitely wouldn't have been what I said last time. But I hosted New Year's Eve this year. So we had 12 mates over, which was so nice. And I'm a big, big fan of, like I say, Asian food, but Vietnamese food is definitely one of my favorite cuisines. I love it so much. Actually, a school friend of mine called Thuy, who is unbelievably sweet and lovely and talented, she has a restaurant in Angel called the Little Viet Kitchen. And oh, she's incredible. Her food is divine. And she has written a cookbook. So I've been meaning to cook for ages because I just love Vietnamese food. And I was flicking through and I thought, I found this dish I just thought sounded perfect. It's slow cooked beef in coconut water with loads of lemongrass and star anise and cinnamon. Anyway, I made it for New Year's Eve with all my mates. And honestly, I think it's been one of the most successful dinner parties I've had, because I basically made this dish essentially the day before, because we all know slow cooked meals like that taste better the next day.
Yeah.
Right. The key to being a good dinner party host is basically not cooking.
Yeah.
Right. So when I was younger and I was trying to impress all my mates at the age of whatever and make food, like I didn't quite figure out that actually be present. Don't be faffing around. You're not a Michelin star chef. So it's taken me a long time to realize that. Yeah, I think it was the best dinner party because basically I made this dish the day before. I served it. She told me to serve it with loads of French stick bread, like brandy style.
Yeah.
And I just had loads of steaming hot rice as well. And genuinely, I think now if I ever have to cook dinner for anyone, I would do it. It was so, so good. It was just really tender beef shin. Had the sweetness from the coconut water without being rich like coconut milk.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Loads of star anise and cinnamon lemongrass, and it was just phenomenal.
That sounds
people just lost their
really
mind.
Good.
Yeah.
How did you follow that? Did you follow it with a pudding?
What did I do? I followed it with we did a few puddings. Pete had made being like Christmas time, Pete had made a gingerbread house.
Oh, had he?
Wow. But it was a Moomin gingerbread house.
Oh.
I know, he's ridiculous.
He's a man of many talents.
He is so cute. He basically is obsessed with biscuits. So he wants to eat biscuits, so he just makes them. And someone had given us a gingerbread house kit from Moomin Land, because we call each other Moomin, basically. So we're obsessed with Moomins. And had given him a Moomin gingerbread house kit, which he took very seriously and was actually really, really difficult. Took him 2 days.
Oh my God.
Like my heart really went out for him. And then I also made like a flourless chocolate cardamom, sort of trying to keep with the spice theme. I made this flourless chocolate cardamom cake with loads of hazelnuts in it, which was also really nice. And we just put in like a spread of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds amazing. So one thing that we ask everyone on Desert Island Dishes is, what is your favorite ever cookbook? Your sort of most treasured cookbook?
That's really hard because I have a lot of cookbooks. I'm going to say Falling Cloudberries by Tessa Quiroz.
Ooh.
I adore Tessa Quiroz. I think she is someone that really made, I don't know, I can't know how to word it. Before I bought Falling Cloudberries, and I bought it when it came out, cookbooks had always seemed very functional, you know, and I think she was the first person to really get me into food writing and the styling. And I just connected to this book, I think, because she's half Cypriot as well. So there's a lot of references. I think it was the first time I'd read a book where there was references to food that I knew. And it's very beautifully done. And it's just, for me, it was like a bit of a Bible when it came out. And and I would cherish, I just cherished it. And I still think she's a phenomenal writer and someone who I sort of look up to and respect very much. And I remember thinking, I want to be Tessa Quiroz, which is kind of a weird thing to say. Sorry, Tessa. And actually we chat now and she's still amazing. But, you know, at that time, I just remember thinking, wow, that's it. I get it. And it's definitely one of my most splattered cookbooks, which, yeah, I think is always a really good sign.
Yeah, a very good sign. I can't believe it, but we're on to the final seventh desert island dish. And that is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island.
I can't. I don't even know. I don't even know, Margie. I don't know what to tell you.
You can have many courses.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. This is going to be really long.
That's okay. I've got all day.
I just want to eat all my granny's food.
Okay, yeah, that is, you can have a spread.
It's really funny. We often do that thing, what's your favourite food? And apart from Cypriot food, I'd say Indian food is my absolute favourite. But like I've said to you before, and I bore on about it, I am a hugely sentimental person. I'm so sentimental. I'm very emotional. And for me, food and cooking is about people. It's not about having a foam or a caviar or whatever. It's about love. So my favourite food is food that's cooked by my mum, my aya. So it would be basically just a table filled with things from them. It would be afghol lemoni. It would be that soup, the egg and the chicken soup. And it would be I lost one of my ayahs a few years ago. It would be her vine leaves, because I actually realised, I was never a huge fan of stuffed vine leaves. But hers were the only ones I would eat. And then I realised after she died, I never ate them again. Just because I didn't want anyone else.
And yeah.
Hers were different. They were sweet and they melt in the mouth. And when people give me vine leaves, I'm like, what the fuck's that? It's just, they're shit. So
what did she do that was different?
You know, it was different, actually. She would cook them on the hob, not in the oven. And she would grate fresh tomatoes into the water that they were cooked in, because basically you roll the vine leaves and you make your filling, whatever that may be, and you layer them in the dish, and then you pour water over them, obviously to cook the rice, and into that water she would feed it with really good olive oil, and she would grate fresh tomatoes into it, so there would be this natural sweetness to them, which is not everyone does, well, hardly anyone does that. And when I was writing to Verna and researching the book, and I was spending time in Cyprus, she has many sisters, and I cooked vine leaves with all the sisters, and they actually do it the same. It was the first time I'd eaten them in years. And I was like, oh my God, they're just like my ayahs, because obviously they're sisters, right? So I would eat her vine leaves, and my other ayah who's still around, you know, she's incredible with puddings. Like, I would eat all her puddings. And I think for me, it would just be a table.
What's her speciality pudding?
It's called Yalda Bureko. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that
old chestnut. It's basically they're phyllo cigars filled with custard.
Ooh, yeah.
But then they're drenched in a sugar syrup. So, and she makes them really small, so it kind of feels like finger food, even though it's a pudding.
Yeah.
So you can eat like 10 and you'll be like, I've just eaten
the best kind.
It's fine.
Just had a canapé.
Just had a canapé. Just sitting there. There's a tray of them. But I've only had like a smidgen. It's fine, because she made 500, by the way. So it would, yeah, I would have to have probably a mezze, literally, of just all of my family's food, I think.
That sounds amazing. And in the nicest possible way, I'm very much looking forward to you going to the desert island, because I'm going to eat this with you. So
great. Great. Thank you.
Georgie, thank you so much for letting us hear your desert island dishes.
Oh, thank you.
So many good little nuggets in that one, and kind of amazing if someone's answer to a desert island dish can actually make you cry. I think that might be a first. I'm so excited about her new book. It's going to be wonderful. I will put the link to pre-order it in the show notes. If you're listening and you haven't yet left a review, now is your chance. It really is quick, I promise. But mostly, thank you so much for listening. Don't forget that you can find me on Instagram at Margie Nomura. And you can visit the website desertislanddishes.co, where you'll find loads of different recipes, kitchen tips and tricks. And I will see you next time. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.